I think it's important to note that the decision of governments to support housing as a commodity or as an investment, and the complementary decisions to withdraw conceptually and in practice from housing as a social good, cannot be regarded as just, oh, any old policy decision. Housing is not gold. Gold is a commodity. Housing is not. It's a human right. Unfortunately, housing as a place of warmth, of security, and love, of shared stories and memories, is losing its currency.
That's Leilani Farha, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Leilani Farha on the financialization of housing. From Seattle to Toronto, the cost of owning a home is soaring. Rents are no better, accelerated by neoliberal economic doctrine. A paradigm shift in housing has occurred in recent years. There's a growing disconnect between housing as a human right and housing as a financial vehicle for investment. We've come a long way from FDR's remarkable 1944 State of the Union address, where he advocated for the right of every family to a decent home. Today, housing is viewed by the global investor class as a commodity to be bought and sold in markets, a repository for capital, and a means of accumulating wealth. Financialization of housing causes gentrification, undermines community, exacerbates inequality, and contributes to the disgrace of homelessness. We need to develop and encourage politics that not only restores housing as a universal human right, but to make it affordable as well. Our guest today is Leilani Farha. She's Special Rapporteur on the Right to Adequate Housing, appointed by the United Nations Human Rights Council. She was also Executive Director of Canada Without Poverty, an NGO based in Ottawa. A lawyer by training, she has worked all over the world on the implementation of economic and social rights. She spoke at the University of Colorado in Boulder. And now, Leilani Farha.
Many years ago, I met a woman in New Orleans named Naomi. This was in the aftermath of Katrina, you'll recall, the huge hurricane that opened the levees. I met Naomi outside of her destroyed home. She was African American, in her 60s, physically disabled, using a wheelchair. Naomi wanted to show me her home. It was a small white bungalow with steps leading up to the front door. I offered to help her get up the stairs, but she refused, telling me she wanted me to see her daily reality. So she hoisted herself up out of her wheelchair and proceeded to drag herself up the steps. It was about, well, we use Celsius in Canada, it was like 45 degrees Celsius in her house. And there were bugs swarming everywhere, so much so I couldn't take notes because I was swatting myself. Her floorboards were torn up, and I could see right down to the foundation of her home. There was no working toilet. In fact, there was no running water in the house. She was using a dry, what we call a dry toilet, and then carting away the refuse when she could. It was, in my opinion, hell. After Naomi told me her story, I asked her how she felt living in the richest country in the world in these conditions. And Naomi looked at me, and without skipping a beat, she said, "Abandoned." This sense of abandonment is something I hear repeatedly. The idea that if you're poor and homeless, you don't count. You're invisible. in some instances, not treated as a human being. I have heard it countless times everywhere I go. I heard it when I interviewed the survivors of the Grenfell Tower tragedy in the UK. I heard it in Portugal when meeting with people in informal settlements outside of Lisbon. I heard it in Roma communities in Serbia, and I heard it in San Francisco from people living under the highways, in Oakland from folks living near railway tracks and living in cars, and from residents in Skid Row in LA. The question is, how did we get here? Or as I rather ineloquently said recently in an off-the-cuff comment at a community meeting in LA, that of course my comment was picked up by the media, I said, how the f*** did we get here? And please don't tweet that now. Naomi's words have long reverberated in my head. Abandoned. Abandoned by whom exactly? Naomi had a community of support. That was obvious to me. Family members, friends, community workers hauling water in and out of her house, helping her get to her doctor's appointments, helping her find food. No, by abandoned, she meant her government had abandoned her. And she's right. Governments the world over have abandoned their responsibility for housing. Let's remember, worldwide, 100 million people are living in the streets, facing daily threats to life and security, and this number is on the rise. 1.6 billion people lack access to an adequate home, living in informal settlements or encampments or tent cities, under the constant threat of being evicted, most lacking clean water and sanitation, requirements of the right to adequate housing. Across the world, as I said, homelessness is increasing pretty much everywhere except Finland. In the US, there are at least 500,000 people who are homeless, with the bulk of them in California and in the West, including here in Colorado. In both North America and in Europe, responses to homelessness criminalize and stigmatize people for carrying out the activities they need to carry out in order to survive. Things like sitting, eating, and sleeping. This is something that is very familiar in Denver and in Boulder itself, where you have urban camping bans and no smoking in public, certain public zone bans, both of which disproportionately affect people who are living in homelessness. In many places across the world, homelessness is directly related to the unaffordability of housing. In cities across the world, housing costs are skyrocketing and not at all commensurate with incomes, making it obviously impossible for moderate and low-income residents to manage. Let's zero in a little bit on what's happening here in Colorado in this regard. So in Boulder, from 2010 to 2015, so a five-year period, the average home price increased 4 times faster than the increase in average household income in the same five-year period. In Metro Denver, since 2011, wages have gone up by 11.4%. But rents went up by 46%, and home prices are up by half. Communities near Denver's urban core are especially vulnerable. Home values in the neighborhoods of Globeville, and Swansea escalated nearly 70% in a two-year period from 2013 to 2015. A local real estate site says that the median rent for one bedrooms in this state has risen 22.4% since the beginning of 2014, which is twice the nationwide increase. So you've got yourselves a problem here in Colorado. Denver's rents now sit 12.6% above the national average. A study from about a year ago said that in terms of home ownership, Boulder is the fifth most unaffordable metropolitan area in the U.S. after various spots where in California and Hawaii. When I was preparing for this lecture, I started, you know, rummaging around the internet as one does, and I came across this story and I just thought I'd read it to you because to me it really typifies what's happening here in Colorado, in Denver, in Boulder, and actually in many places across the world. After losing her job in the Great Recession, that's what you all call it, we call it the global financial crisis, Lisa Gonzalez, 34, and her four kids spent 2 years living in a van until she took a job as an apartment manager in order to obtain shelter. 5 years ago, she qualified for an income-restricted apartment where her rent runs $737 a month. It's fairly reasonable. She married Francisco, a mover, who had three children. Their family of eight live in a three-bedroom apartment on Mount Loretto Apartments on South Federal Boulevard. Cramped conditions and rising crime in the neighborhood pushed the family to look for a larger place to live, one where the kids could play freely outside. But almost none of Denver's newest apartments were built with families in mind. The three-bedroom homes Lisa and Francisco ran across rented for around $2,400 a month and up, which would have wiped out much of the $3,500 to $4,000 the pair earn each month in service jobs. The family considered moving outside Denver, but finding something remotely affordable required a two-hour drive. Quote, "We were feeling hopeless. There was nothing that would suffice for us, nothing at all," she said. But the pair didn't give up. After four failed attempts, the family qualified to purchase a five-bedroom home in Sheridan through Habitat for Humanity. If all goes as planned, they should be in their new home by spring. Quote, "We feel like in Willy Wonka when Charlie won the golden ticket," she said. Even as she celebrates her good fortune, she thinks about a desperate coworker at King Supers who is paying $1,700 a month for a two-bedroom apartment. When people ask her about taking her spot at Mount Loretto Apartments, she tells them the waiting list is 3 to 5 years. Cities in Colorado are in good company. Professor Manuel Albers, who's the leading expert on the financialization of housing, has said that 80% of cities in the global north have experienced the same phenomenon as have most cities in the global south, where the trends have been, in fact, far worse. That trend that I'm talking about is skyrocketing housing costs and stagnating income levels. And so that graph is everywhere around the world now. And it is always the most vulnerable who are affected, persons with disabilities who are either institutionalized or deinstitutionalized without adequate supports, migrants who are often considered less deserving of public supports as newcomers, women, single mothers, youth leaving violent households with nowhere to go, families living in poverty or in low income, Indigenous peoples who have historically and continue to be forced off their lands and subject, obviously, to the practices of colonialism, LGBTQ, and others facing the harshest forms of discrimination. The most vulnerable people are simply being pushed out of their homes, neighborhoods, and communities. In my opinion, all of this is testament to Naomi's claim and the claim of so many others of government abandonment. In particular, I think it's their abandonment to the commitment to human rights. So again, how did we get here? What are the root causes of this here and now? The root cause lies, in my opinion, in an ideology that was promulgated in the 1980s and that took hold by the end of the 80s and that became the dominant paradigm in the 1990s throughout the world and which continues until today. And that dominant paradigm is neoliberalism. And I admit that when I first started articulating the problem as rooted in neoliberalism, I felt a little bit self-conscious because I worried that I would come off sounding like a predictable lefty. But as special rapporteur, I have had the very unfortunate opportunity to get up close and personal with neoliberalism. I have seen it in action in Chile, where in fact neoliberalism was born through Milton Friedman's thinking. And I've seen it in agreements between the International Monetary Fund and regional banks and many countries around the world that have imposed austerity measures and forced the liberalization of the housing sector. Neoliberalism is an ideology that believes that the unregulated market, supported by the state, ironically, will respond to need, and that governments should take a big step backward from social protections and supports. In the housing sector, it means a number of things, including reducing protections for tenants, such as security of tenure, selling off social housing and not producing more, and generally making sure housing is wide open to the unregulated market. In the 1990s and early 2000s, that version of neoliberalism looked pretty bad. So when that was first introduced, people were pretty like, whoa, what's going on here? When you add the newer phenomenon of financialization of housing into the mix, it creates the impossible housing conditions that we are witnessing in cities around the world, including many in the US. Los Angeles, San Jose, California, San Francisco, Oakland, New York, and now I'm learning Boulder and Denver. By financialization, I mean where housing is no longer viewed as a home and instead is viewed as a commodity, a place to park excess capital, or where it's used, where housing is used as a financial instrument to leverage capital for other investments. Now, housing has long been financialized. Home ownership through the purchasing of mortgages is a form of financialization, and it's existed for a very long time now. And that is obviously mortgages are a financial product linked to housing. That is not what I'm talking about now. What I'm talking about is something quite new. I'm talking about the unprecedented wealth in the world that's being parked in housing, used as a profit generator. Sophisticated financial instruments turn housing into a very lucrative stock, resulting in huge profits for some and driving up rents and reducing the availability of affordable units for others. Housing is now invaded by financial actors, banks, pension funds, private equity firms, real estate investment trusts, shareholders, and rich individuals, all of whom view housing predominantly as a place to park excess capital, to turn profit and generate more money for themselves. Few of whom view housing as home. And they're buying up properties, particularly in neighborhoods they call undervalued, where affordable units still exist. Properties out of which they know they can squeeze more profits and use to leverage and generate more capital. And beyond all of this buying, evicting, and flipping, these financial actors use their political power to lobby governments to develop the legal and taxation infrastructure necessary for new financial instruments related to housing so that they can make more money. And they use this same power to lobby to ensure weak tenant protections remain in place. If anyone followed the Prop 10 stuff that was going on in California, you'll know what I'm talking about. So this, my friends, is the new housing landscape. There are, of course, other manifestations of financialization that you'll probably be familiar with, such as short-term rental platforms like Airbnb, which results in the increase in the development of luxury accommodations and the reduction of available housing stock that could be used for affordable rentals. There are these things called real estate investment trusts in countries around the world. And in fact, one of the biggest real estate investment trusts is based here in Colorado, in Denver, one of the biggest ones in the US. This is when a company owns a building or several buildings, puts it on the stock market, and allows shareholders to invest in it. The rental income from those units is, in fact, what investors get back. That's their return. So you can imagine the incentive to make sure those rents constantly are increasing to satisfy all of those stockholders waiting for a good return on their investment. Add to financialization the phenomenon that is certainly familiar in these parts of high-tech firms bringing in thousands of employees to a city. And what we find is that people are being pushed out of their homes, neighborhoods, and communities. Rents are rising, people are being evicted in greater numbers, and sometimes falling into homelessness. Existing stock is deteriorating, new stock is luxury or high-end and intended for investors or the upper middle class, but not for service industry earners or tenants or students. With no social safety net, people have nowhere to turn. So where is government in all of this? All of the structures and arrangements are occurring through enabling legislation and financial structures that governments have helped to create and that governments have failed to regulate. While governments have abandoned tenants and low-income residents, they have certainly not abandoned investors. And the importance of the relationship with investors, between governments and investors, cannot be underestimated. Let's consider one of the world's biggest investors. It took me a while to figure all this stuff out, like whose money is being invested? Well, whose money? Pension funds, of course, pension funds. So, if you look at the main countries where pension funds are housed, the US maintained its grip on the top rank with close to 40% share. So 7 of the top performing 20 pension funds are based here in the US. So you've got a lot of rich pension funds here, let's just put it that way. As I understand it, approximately 50 pension funds in the US are investing in those real estate investment trusts that I mentioned, REITs, REITs we call them. And REITs receive very special tax considerations in exchange for distributing at least 90% of their cash flow earnings to shareholders. So a REIT basically gets a preferred tax status, and it's the only kind of trust in many countries that gets this preferential tax status. So for anyone paying into a pension fund, rest assured your money may very well be landing in residential real estate. Although I did try to figure out whether pension funds here at the university are going into real estate, and I don't think they are, so you might be safe. What we all need to really get our heads around, though, is that housing or residential real estate is now big business. In fact, it's the biggest business of all businesses, valued at $163 trillion U.S. dollars. That's more than twice the total of the entire world's GDP. The annual profits of the global tobacco industry is about $500 billion per year. And the value of housing, $163 trillion. It's integral to economies, to business and to financial worlds. So now you know, this is what we're up against if we care about this at all. So when we say we want to end homelessness and ensure access to adequate, affordable, and safe housing, this is what we're up against. So tinkering with programs and policies, not enough. We're going to need to, in my opinion, do something much more. I think it's important to note that the decision of governments to support housing as a commodity or as an investment, and the complementary decisions to withdraw conceptually and in practice from housing as a social good cannot be regarded as just, oh, any old policy decision. Housing is not gold. Gold is a commodity. Housing is not. It's a human right that governments around the world, including the US government in its own way, have committed to. Unfortunately, housing as a place of warmth, of security, and love, of shared stories and memories, is losing its currency. So, how do we get there? How do we get back to housing as home? I think what's required is a seismic, paradigmatic shift. So, in partnership with umbrella organization that represents cities from around the world and the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, I have launched a new multi-stakeholder global movement called The Shift. The movement understands that deprivations of the right to adequate housing are not just program failures or policy challenges, but are actually human rights violations of the highest order, depriving those affected of the most basic human rights to dignity and to security and to life itself. The Shift recognizes that housing can no longer be understood as a commodity or an asset or a place to grow wealth, but must be embraced as a social good necessary for the well-being of the individual and for society alike, akin to how housing is viewed in a very few places right now, Vienna, Finland. But more than anything, if we're going to solve homelessness and grossly inadequate housing in all countries around the world, I think what we really need is for governments to show up, all levels of government. And they need to show up in ways that they have long abandoned, and they need to show up in new ways to counter the very sophisticated and deeply entrenched causes of homelessness and inadequate housing. So the Shift movement is urging governments to adopt comprehensive human rights-based housing strategies. Governments need to adopt a framework that will result in structural change that will prevent homelessness as a priority and that will address barriers to adequate, affordable housing. And the Shift views human rights as essential to this framework. So, you know, why human rights? If you ask yourself, what is the experience of homelessness or grossly inadequate housing? What's the experience of evictions, of stereotypes about being homeless and stigmatization? What is all of that? I think the answer is that all of that is an assault on human dignity. I think all of that challenges what it means to be human. So these are human rights concerns. That's what human rights is about, protecting dignity. And human rights concerns should trigger human rights responses. Human rights change the way governments interact with people who are homeless and inadequately housed. They recognize people not as beneficiaries of charity, but rather as rights holders, active subjects, empowered to engage and be involved in decisions that affect their lives. A rights-based approach to housing clarifies who is accountable to whom? All levels of government are accountable to people. Human rights incorporate universal norms, which bring coherence and coordination to multiple areas of law and policy. They provide like a common purpose, a shared set of values, something you can kind of count on. And human rights recognize the structural causes of housing disadvantage, and they propose structural solutions.
You're listening to Leilani Farha on the financialization of housing. This is Independent Alternative Radio. We're offering MP3s, PDFs, and printed transcripts of this program free of charge. Just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
I did a report a little while back that outlined 10 principles of what rights-based housing strategies would look like. I don't want to highlight all of those 10 because it's a little bit boring to just provide you with a list, but let me just give you a few highlights. The first, and this is a tall order because so many governments are just absolutely refusing this, including my own in Canada, but in order for a housing strategy to be rights-based, you have to have the right to housing somewhere in legislation or law or a constitution. And then you need to be able to have remedies for violations of that right. And without that, you don't have human rights going on. And that is very tough for some governments. They absolutely don't want to legislate the right to housing. They think it's going to lead to an enormous number of claims, probably because they're not implementing the right to housing, so then they have opened themselves up to a lot of claims. They think it's going to be costly, etc. The other thing strategies have to do is they have to ensure what we call rights-based participation. They have to be inclusive of the most vulnerable populations. And when I say rights-based participation, I don't mean, and I've seen this in some places, you know, like checkmark, oh, we had a round table to talk about homelessness in our city and we invited a poor person, check, you know, there, we included them. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about actually understanding that people living in homelessness and grossly inadequate housing are actually experts in their own lives. And they probably know better than any of us think exactly how to solve what's going on for them and their families. And if you don't give people who are affected by a problem an opportunity to express what they see as the barriers, we're never going to achieve results and solutions that work for people. Again, that's a tall order. I already mentioned this, you know, in passing, but strategies have to ensure access to justice. And by that, I don't just mean access to courts. For most people, courts are not friendly places. For people living in homelessness, oh gosh, in Colorado, in Denver, and Boulder, you know, courts and law is not generally a friendly place, right? It's where it's the criminalization. So we have to be more creative. I've seen some pretty interesting things at city levels. Councils being formed. Ombudspersons often are a little less intimidating than courts and a little more humane. Independent tribunals, commissions, even I've seen in my own country, they're trying to create an advocate position, a housing advocate position. There has to be a place for people to go to say my right to housing has been violated and to seek a remedy for that violation. We say in the human rights world, human rights are illusory if you can't claim them and have a remedy for violations. I think strategies have to be accountable to budgeting and tax justice. You're hearing a lot about that in this country right now, thanks to certain congresswomen, newly elected, you know, that there should be a 70% tax on people with uber wealth. Those sorts of things are responsive to, are human rights compliant. I would say on that tax issue that we need targeted taxes. It's not just good enough to just tax people. You have to say we're going to tax people and X percentage is going to be for genuinely affordable housing, is going to be to deal with the causes of homelessness, etc. Rights-based strategies should be based in time. You know, there should be goals, timelines. There should be general accountability to the public, to the people that are supposed to be benefiting from the strategies. I don't know how much you know about this, but a few years ago, countries around the world, including the U.S., committed to the Sustainable Development Goals. Does anyone know what the, some people are nodding? Yeah. So Goal 11 commits governments to ensuring access for all to safe, affordable, and adequate housing by 2030. They're supposed to be addressing affordability and inadequacy, or unaffordability and inadequacy. So we're now 4 years into what was a 15-year deadline. So with 11 years to go, I mean, are we getting any closer? I think that the seismic shift is what we need. I don't think we're going to meet those goals on a global level if something big doesn't shift. I think that while governments need to shift to what I've suggested, new rights-based approaches to housing, other sectors need to shift too. The housing and homelessness sector needs to start doing its work differently. And I'm going to put myself right in that camp because I run an NGO in Canada and we deal with housing and homelessness. And the housing and homelessness sector, I think, has to change its focus dramatically. It needs to recognize that this is a different fight that we're in right now than we've been in before. And it's going to require different tools and different strategies. I have to say, I haven't seen a housing and homelessness sector anywhere that I think is really grappling with this stuff. We have to realize that it's not just about getting more money to programs and services. It's not just about having more social housing built, although that would help. It's just so much bigger than that, which I've tried to describe today. I think lawyers and legal thinkers need to shift as well. Professor Saskia Sassen, she says that, you know, so much of what's happening with respect to housing and homelessness is related to how laws have been deployed to enable finance to move in and out and turn our homes into financial instruments. So if that's right, if she's right, and I think she is, then I think we need law to undo this, and we need lawyers to undo it. I think as a lawyer, I'm allowed to say that we aren't always as creative as we can be on the progressive side of law. I've certainly seen in my own circles a certain timidity, not the full-fledged creativity that's going to be necessary to address what's going on here. I think law schools have a role to play. I think all students maybe should have to take, be required if they're not in this school, maybe they should be required to take certain access to justice type courses. I know some law schools have started to do that. Compelling legal community service hours, assisting private bar lawyers in advancing progressive strategic litigation, etc. I do think I am going to start outreaching more to law schools and law students. The shift, I should say, as a global movement has started to grow. 32 cities from around the world have committed to reclaiming the right to housing, and they've signed this thing called the Cities for Housing Declaration. So big cities like Amsterdam, Berlin, Mexico City, Seoul, Montreal, Paris, have all said that they are committed to reclaiming the right to housing, and they are embarking on enacting strategies, hopefully, that will be rights-based. So one idea I had was to try to get, so cities have committed to the shift. I have national human rights institutions have started to commit to the shift as well. I'm working on legislators and elected officials. I was wondering whether I shouldn't start recruiting law schools or law professors to commit to the shift. I'm not putting anyone on the spot. But I will say this, to get the ball rolling, I just had this idea when I was preparing for this speech. So to get the ball rolling, I yelled upstairs to my partner, who is a professor of law at the University of Ottawa, to see if he would be the first professor to join the shift, because he teaches a course in access to justice and is involved in a big strategic litigation case against an asset management firm that evicted 105 racialized households in my city so that they could build luxury apartments where those low-income folks were living. And he's really engaged in that. So I asked him, will you join the shift? And he said he would be pleased to be the first professor to join the shift. So we have one, and I will have private conversations with the dean about whether he might be the second one. But honestly and seriously, I think if we're going to make change and if we're going to make this shift that I'm talking about, we're going to need to come together in new ways and develop new partnerships and be bigger and kind of bolder than we have been before. And I think we need to build sector by sector and sort of to counter this incredibly powerful force that we're up against. But if joining the shift isn't really on your agenda or you're not that interested, I do have a few recommendations I'm going to end off with. Here's sort of what you might do. Here's your to-do list. You could demand that your governments, local government, state, national, adopt rights-based housing strategies and recognize homelessness as an immediate human rights priority. You could host public screenings of the film, Push, and invite unlikely allies to that screening to start having provocative discussions. You could start a pension fund campaign, if you're paying into a pension, where they invest in residential real estate. You'd have to ask your pension fund, what are you investing my money in? And if they are investing in residential real estate, suggest that they do otherwise. This is happening in the environmental movement, you can imagine, so surely we could do it in the housing movement. And then on a more personal level, I'm going to ask you to think twice before you rent an Airbnb on your next vacation. Find out if Airbnb is regulated in the city where you're traveling to. And lastly, I'm going to ask you, when you're walking on the streets of Boulder or Denver or any other city, except maybe Helsinki, and you see a homeless person, I want you to look at that person who's living in homelessness, and what I want you to see is the failure of that government to implement the right to housing. That's what I want you to see. So, I think ultimately what I'm asking all of us to do is to find your outrage and don't accept what is unacceptable. Push back. We have to stop government's abandonment of people, and we have to stop their abandonment of human rights. Thanks.
Yes. What type of law would you suggest getting into to have the biggest effect?
Well, it depends on how progressive you are. I think that we need to figure out tax law and figure out progressive taxation. So I don't know that you need to be a tax lawyer to do that. I myself knew nothing about financialization of housing 2.5 years ago. Nothing. And I never took business law or BizOrg or whatever it's called. I never took any tax law, whatever. And I don't find it that complicated. It's just a different language, so it's like learning a second language or a third language or whatever. I think knowing human rights law is pretty important.
I had a question for you on Finland and Vienna. Is there anything we can learn from them about what they do, why they don't have that?
Yeah, so the question was, why is it that Vienna and Finland are faring fairly well with respect to homelessness? They're very separate cases, but let's take Finland. So Finland first of all, has the right to housing in their constitution. And they also have a culture there where homelessness is viewed culturally as unacceptable. And it's like just unacceptable. So they had as a mindset a desire to address homelessness that was already that had been allowed to happen. So they set about to try to reduce homelessness, and though they hit their target, they didn't do as well as they had wanted to do, and they were using a very particular model called the Housing First model, which is where you provide housing to people regardless of their circumstances, and then you deal with their social circumstances if that's necessary, so you provide them with social supports. The Finland model, I should say, of Housing First is very particular. Those social supports for people who are part of the Housing First model are ongoing until that family or individual can live autonomously. So that might be a lifelong of supports, or it could be 2 months, depending on the person's circumstances. But the state has committed to providing those supports for the duration that that family or household needs. But they found that while they were successfully housing homeless population, homelessness was still growing. So in other words, new homeless people, right? Because Housing First doesn't solve the causes, it's only solving the existence of homelessness. And so then they set about to try to figure out what the causes were and started changing certain laws and policies, and now they have successfully wrestled down. So they went after the structural causes and were successful. Vienna has a long history of providing social housing for everybody. So it's a really interesting model. It's not just for the most disadvantaged households. Everyone basically has been entitled to social housing in Vienna, and they continue to produce way more social housing than most other cities in Europe, almost all other cities in Europe. They are under some stress, but they are continuing to try to move it with that model. So it's a long history of state support for social housing, and again, a pride in housing. And if you look at Singapore, is also considered one of the more successful places. They also have like a 50-year tradition and history and culture of contributing as a government to social housing and to housing. So there. I think you were first, and then this woman, and then Darren.
Mine is pretty simple. I was just asking that Airbnb phenomena. Are they pretty much the company that's doing that, or are there other examples of companies that are contributing to that problem in similar ways?
Yeah, so the question is about Airbnb and whether it's the only one. It's the most well-known platform, but I was speaking to someone in a hotel association recently. I find myself talking to all sorts of people these days. Very interesting. And he was saying that he's most concerned about Expedia. And I was in Australia on holidays looking for a regular hotel in Melbourne. I just wanted to stay at a regular hotel, and went on to booking.com, and every listing, I could not find a regular hotel. I had to put in names of hotels to get the hotels, if you know what I mean. Otherwise, I was getting all these apartments and condos for rent. So it's not just Airbnb. I think Airbnb is very active. I think they're litigating regulations, right, left, and center. I've heard that the number of litigation they're involved in is huge. And so, in other words, they're feisty, shall we say. But no, I think it is the whole phenomenon of short-term rentals that's the problem. In Portugal, for example, I saw... they don't call it Airbnb, but it's all short-term rental companies there. So yeah.
So what I grapple with in this town, I've been here for 23 years, is that how I was raised is that you would buy a house and leverage it to buy more or build. It was a path to building wealth.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have these large investment firms, etc., buying up. We've got, and we're seeing the problem with that now. I have a ton of friends that are flipping and doing, you know, and now condoizing houses. So what I grapple with, and even if we're presenting to governments, especially in a town where so much wealth has been and is invested in real estate, how would you suggest in micro movements, starting to suggest that backing out of the housing as, you know, I get where you're going with the human rights, but the other countries and cities you're speaking of, if they started in that mindset, I mean, this is a shift. This is mm-hmm. big. And how do you, when a government, like our local government, is appointed or voted in by the people, and we know that in this town in particular, it tends to be the older, wealthy people that are voting and putting them into office, how do you suggest them to vote against themselves or make laws against themselves?
Yeah. I don't have any. Luckily, I'm out of time because that. No, you know, I mean, that is exactly what we're up against. We're changing mindsets. And the thing is, I would differentiate between, I don't think flipping homes is great. Don't get me wrong, I don't think it's great. But that's not, I'm not going after the people who are flipping homes. I'm going after private equity firms that are buying entire buildings that may stand empty, because they're just for investors who have no intention of living there, right? That's what I'm going after. I'm going after the investor who buys three floors of a condominium building. For what purpose? Short-term rental, when it might be some other kind of rental. You know, so it's, I think what I'm trying to do is go, I'm trying to get us back at least to the mom and pop, which is kind of what you're describing. That's how housing markets used to work in Western developed countries, was mostly mom and pop or small, what we call small landlords. I would rather at least go back to that if we could and try to stop these huge players. No one has a chance against the private equity firms. They have so much liquid capital at their fingertips, funded basically by Deutsche Bank. I mean, literally, they have money and they need to get rid of their money, and they, no one can compete with them. That's what I'm trying to stop. And yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
You were just listening to Leilani Farha on the financialization of housing. She spoke at the University of Colorado in Boulder. Leilani Farha is the special rapporteur on the right to adequate housing appointed by the United Nations Human Rights Council. This program is produced by Alternative Radio based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit organization Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such progressive voices as Ralph Nader, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Our special book offer is Nice Racism, How Progressive White People Perpetuate Racial Harm, by Robin DiAngelo. To place a credit card order for CDs of this program, Leilani Farha, on the financialization of housing, just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. We're offering MP3s, PDFs, and printed transcripts of this program free of charge. Just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with the Rolling Stones with Lisa Fisher, recorded live, singing Gimme Shelter.